The following program was taped in front of an audience of real live people.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm the voice so rich, Forbes put it on a list. Chioki Iansen, and here's your host at the Studebaker Theater in downtown Chicago, filling in for Peter Sagal, Tom Papa.
Thanks, Chioki, and thank you, everybody. This week was President's Day, and we're honoring George Washington's 293rd birthday by trying to bake a cake you can safely eat with a wooden teeth.
Just be careful blowing out those candles, George, or your whole mouth is going to go up in flames.
And since we're already celebrating, let's keep the party going with one of our favorite guests from the past few years, actor, writer, and comedian John Leguizamo.
Peter started by asking him how it felt to finally achieve the pinnacle of show business success, his own PBS special.
Yes, an overnight success after 40 years.
So the series American Historia, The Untold History of Latinos, I understand was inspired by one of your many one-man shows, in this case, your own personal examination of Latino history, right?
Yes, you know, it was based on Latino Latin history from morons because I learned my son was being bullied. And I wanted to give him, weaponize his knowledge and his history of his people. You know, I didn't know we finished building the railroads. I didn't realize we were the first fighters to create unions in the 1930s. And then, you know, we've been persecuted, but we've also contributed so much. We just reached a milestone last year. We contributed $3.2 trillion to the GDP yearly as a Latino culture.
Wow. My son is a huge fan of yours, and by that, of course, aww, I mean because of your Ice Age movies and TV
yes
shows.
Yes, I'm so happy to hear that. We're about to do Ice Age 6.
Wow. So you play, for those unlucky not to have seen the 4,000 Ice Age movies and TV shows and video games, you play Sid the Sloth, a prehistoric sloth, and we read that you actually got really deep into the research for his voice. Is that right?
Well, you know, yeah, because I did like 50 voices for the director, Chris Wedge, and he said, I just want you to do your voice. I go, I don't want to do my voice. I want to do a voice. I'm an actor. So I did, you know, southern voice for the sloth because he's slow. Then I went a little more ghetto on it. Come on, what you want? And he goes, nah. So then I got Discovery Channel footage. And I saw that sloths stored food in their cheek pouches, and it would ferment, and they'd get drunk. And so I started eating the sandwich, and I put it in my cheek pouches, and I walked around the house waiting for it to ferment, and it didn't. But what happened was that I got slushy in my mouth, and I called the director, Chris, guess who this is? And he was like, I have no idea. It's Sid the Sloth. I found myself, and that's how I did the book.
Wow.
That's amazing.
You do belong on PBS.
Yeah. Next time I'm sitting watching the movies with my son, I say, you know, that's historically accurate. Among the many, many things you do, you've done these one-man shows where you play all these characters, and as you just demonstrated, you're really, really, really good at voices. Have you ever used that power for evil?
Yes, of course. I mean, when I was much younger, it was great because people, you know, when the school would complain, they would call my house, and I would answer as my mom, and I go, "Oh, he, what? No, he's fantastic. Oh, you want to expel him? Well, expel it for me." And I would mess with them for hours, and they wouldn't be able to expel me.
Really?
And they tried to expel me.
Did your mother know you were doing that?
No, please. No. Well, now she knows now because you blabbered.
You mentioned your mother. We also read that, like, your mother to this day sees, like, everything you do and offers a critique afterwards.
Yeah, my mom's very judgmental. And I think I get it from her a little bit. We both watch PBS too much.
Yeah, I know, man. I'm telling you.
And she does. She comes to every show and, like, she sits front row. And then she comes afterwards, oh, John, that was fantastic, but I didn't really like the punchline. It didn't really hit the way I thought it would hit. It didn't murder. And I was like, Mom, please stop criticizing. You're just my mom. Just be unconditionally loving for once.
Is she going to critique this? Is she going to listen and go, oh, I don't think you talked about me enough?
I'm not going to tell her about this.
Okay, yeah. All right, that's fine.
That's the only way to keep her away.
Well, John Leguizamo, it is such a pleasure to talk to you again. And this time we have asked you here to play a game that we're calling...
Can We Fix It? Yes, we can.
So this year, as I'm sure you know, because everybody's been celebrating, this year marks the 25th anniversary of Bob the Builder.
Oh, wow.
The beloved kids show about a British contractor whose trucks are alive. So in honor of that, we're going to ask you three questions about, I guess we'd call him Mr. Builder. Get two out of three right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Bill, who is John Leguizamo playing for?
Nora Wing of Ithaca, New York.
All right. Here's your first question. You ready?
Go for it. I'll do my best.
Bob the Builder is popular around the world, but some changes needed to be made internationally to show there, including which of these? A, in France, they had to add clocks to the background to prove that no one goes over their 35-hour approved work week. B, in Canada, Bob always includes maple syrup as a construction material in his projects. Or C, in Japan, they had to add a fifth finger to his animated four-finger hand so that kids did not think Bob the Builder was a member of the Yakuza.
I'm going to go with Canada and maple syrup because it sounds ridiculous but plausible.
So you think that Bob the Builder in Canada, they just cut in things as a now to like to make sure this sticks. Here's some maple syrup. That's.
And they go, sorry.
Oh, wow. I thought I was in, that was amazing. I thought I was in Toronto. The answer was actually C. You see, as is well known in Japan, if you're a Yakuza member and you displease your boss, they cut off one of your fingers. So a four-fingered animated character would have unpleasant connotations.
Oh, so that's dark.
It is. It really is.
I didn't want to go that dark.
All right. Here's your next question, John. You have two more chances. Bob the Builder is more than just a very popular kids TV show. Which of these is another example of Bob's cultural dominance? A, he once went to number one on the UK singles charts with a cover of Mambo No. 5. B, Alexander McQueen had an entire runway show of Bob the Builder-inspired designs. Or C, he had a best-selling cookbook called Can You Bake It? Yes, You Can.
Oh, man. I'm going to go with A.
You're going with A? You're right. Yes, he did a cover
finally.
Of Mambo No. 5.
What a relief.
All right, you have one more question. If you get this right, you win. Bob the Builder popped up in a surprising place a few years ago when people browsing the on-demand menu of Britain's Channel 5 saw a picture of Bob as the image representing what show? A, the season premiere of Britain's Got Talent. B, a documentary about 9/11. Or C, the movie Eyes Wide Shut.
Eyes Wide Shut. Sort of the sexual, all the
yes,
sexual.
Yes, I know, yes.
Loving.
Yes, Bob, you know, just imagine Bob the Builder wearing one of those weird masks that Tom Cruise was having, you know?
I won't picture that, so no. I'm going to go with A again.
You're going to go with A again. Britain's Got Talent. The idea of like, oh, this guy's got talent. He can build stuff.
Yeah, he can build things, right?
I mean, sadly, the answer was B, a documentary about 9/11.
I meant B.
He meant B, Bill. He meant B.
Let's give it to him.
Yeah, okay. I'm sure. I mean, I thought I had misheard you. And of course you were right.
I have a New York City accent.
Exactly. Yeah, and
A-B.
Yeah, exactly. B. You know, apparently if the way it worked was if Channel 5, you know, and this is how it works, you turn on your streaming service, there are these icons indicating the shows you could be watching. And when Channel 5, they didn't happen to have a picture to go with any given show. They just plugged in a picture from Bob the Builder. So Bob was the image for this 9/11 documentary and also something called Murdered by My Daughter. So, Bill, how did John Leguizamo do in our quiz?
2 out of 3.
Yay!
2 out of 3.
Now you did good.
Amazing. I'm brilliant. I belong on PBS. And,
John Leguizamo is an actor, writer, and producer whose new series, Voces, American Historia, The Untold History of Latinos, premieres on PBS September 27th. John Leguizamo, what a great thing to talk to you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good luck with the show. We'll see you next time.
Thank you. So fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Before we wrap up this segment, here's a fun moment with some of our panelists.
Paula, one of the most famous prehistoric animals was the saber-toothed tiger.
Sure.
A fierce and deadly predator.
Oh, yeah.
And scientists now believe they know why they went extinct. What was it?
Because they weren't procreating.
I mean, that has to be correct.
That is, well...
Yeah. More specifically, a lot of the males became unattractive.
Why?
The tooth.
Exactly. They went extinct because of their very big teeth.
Yeah. It's right? just not appealing to a female of any species.
A saber-toothed tiger, formerly a Smilodon, informally Bernie.
A Smilodon?
Yes.
That's adorable. That's like a children's story.
If you talk to a paleontologist and say, do you work with saber-toothed tigers? They'll go, there's no such thing as a saber-toothed tiger. They're called Smilodons.
How do you know that?
I have been reading a lot of books about old animals with my son.
I'm not sure what level these books are, because really, there's one wherein it said, don't talk to scientists who study this and mention saber-toothed tiger, because they will just lose it.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. Yeah. I would like... Wait, Don't Tell Me has a website, doesn't it?
I believe we do, yes.
Okay. I want to see a copy of the book. That cautions the reader.
Yes.
The young reader.
Yeah. Yes. I'm assuming, how old is your son that you're reading
this
book to?
My son is 4.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're not one of those parents who's already pushing your kid to get into college, are you? All right, I want you to go to college, but here's a tip. When you get in there, do not.
For
the love of God.
Yeah. Right. Your mother and I love you very much, but there's one thing which we cannot put.
Coming up, it's lightning.
Wait a minute, coming up. What's the name of the book?
This week, we're celebrating President's Day by building our own team of rivals with some of our favorite guests from the past few years.
I'm having so much fun. I can't wait to see what we do for Autocrats Day next year.
Well, we prepare for that. Here's our interview with Grammy-winning producer Mark Ronson. When he joined us in August of 2023, guest host Nagin Farsad asked him if he remembered the first time he heard the mega hit Uptown Funk in the wild.
I do. I remember being in an Uber and hearing it. Like, I think I was like coming home. Maybe I was a little drunk coming home from a club at 2 a.m. And it was the first time I ever heard it on the radio, and it was the most exciting thing ever. And I remember saying to the driver, I was like, this is me. But he's listening to like Bruno Mars going like, don't believe it, you know, and he's like, it doesn't sound like you. Like, I'm like, oh, so no, I mean, I produced it. But anyway, no, it was so exciting.
Did you have an inkling then that it was going to be this worldwide phenomenon?
Well, not by the Uber driver's reaction, but I also thought that I thought, you know what it was? Mm. That song we worked on for a really long time, about 7 or 8 months, because Bruno was such a perfectionist. I kind of am. Jeff Basker, the other producer, we are in our work. So by the time we finally stopped bickering about it and got it to a point where we all felt good, we're like, wow, if it passed this peanut gallery, at least we know, you know, we feel good about it. But everything that happened after that was just such a wonderful thing. I mean, when you put a song out, it's no longer yours. It belongs to everybody. And then they decide what happens with it. So that's kind of what happened with that song.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about being a DJ. We talked before the show, and as you know, I have, in fact, shaken my booty, as it were, at a club where you were DJing. And it was just an incredible night. It was so fun. But it made me think you probably see a lot of weird stuff on the dance floor. Are you, like, basically embarrassed for everyone as you see them dancing to your music, or...?
No. If anybody's dancing, that's good enough for me. So, I mean, I have seen some... One of my favorite things, you know, in my early days of DJing in clubs in New York in the 90s, RuPaul once came into the club. It was somewhere where I was DJing, and this was when Ru was in sort of plain clothes in a very handsome suit and came up to me and was just like, at the end of the night, you're making me dance so much, you're making my booty hurt. And I just thought that was so cool that I put that on a business card. I just made these little business cards that just said, like, you're making my booty hurt, RuPaul. Available for weddings and bar mitzvahs.
Well, let's talk about Barbie, another worldwide phenomenon. I want to talk to you about scoring the movie, which you also did. Now that you've scored a movie, do you find yourself scoring like dramatic moments in your own life? Or just like mundane, like you're just, oh, you're just like chatting with the barista, and then it's like,
It's funny because now I'm just so hyper attuned to like, it could be the music in a Burger King commercial. I'm like, oh, I see why they did that.
that song legit slaps. BK, yeah, have it your way.
So I heard this weird factoid about you. Is it true that the song I Want to Know What Love Is was written about your mom?
Yes, that is absolutely true.
I would hope so, because that would have been insulting. You don't can't talk about somebody's mama like that.
Yeah, my stepfather, Mick Jones, whom my mom married when I was 10, and he wrote that song, you know, for her, and it's like, I mean, it's definitely setting the bar pretty high, like, as a kid, like, okay, well, you're not going to write anything as good as that for anybody. But also, what was more funny is that he had written a song, he tried to tell that he wrote the song Waiting for a Girl Like You as well, that was another big ballad that he had for her, and she was like, you wrote that song, like, 5 years before you met me. He's like, right, but I was waiting for a girl like you.
Now that's man math right there.
Yeah. I know.
Well, Mark, we've asked you here to play a game that we're calling.
What about that downtown funk?
So you, of course, released the smash hit Uptown Funk. So we're going to ask you about downtown funk or stinky city smells. Amazingly, in this quiz, we only use the word urine once. Now, answer 2 out of 3 questions correctly, and you'll win our prize for one of our listeners. Bill, who is Mark Ronson playing for?
Brad Martin of Seattle, Washington.
All right.
It's a 206. I have to represent.
Yeah.
Brad, let's go.
Let's go.
All right, here's your first question. Most towns come to their funks naturally, but some create their own, including Lincoln, Nebraska, which in the winter smells like what? Is it A, nutmeg, which they mix in with their road salt? Is it B, new car smell from their factory that makes artificial new car smell kicking up production? Or is it C, animal pee, which they spray on their pine trees to keep people from stealing them for Christmas trees?
I'm going to go with C, because that's the funkiest.
And that is correct. The answer is animal pee.
The whole thing about the funk, and I know that I'm not on camera for most people, is like that kind of face, you know, and like nutmeg is not making me.
All right, here's your next question. Lots of cities have bad smells, but not every city has a song about how bad it smells. Which of these is a real recording? Is it A, The Aroma of Tacoma? Is it B, My Dear Eureka, How Eureka? Or is it C, Pueblo, Colorado, smells like a rotten egg made of dead skunks?
Good luck punching that one up, Ronson.
I'm going to go with A.
Yes, it is The Aroma of Tacoma. Some combination of a paper mill, an oil refinery, and Tacoma's natural stank made a smell so strong, it was immortalized in song. Not gonna lie, it's a bop, actually.
Do you know that mill is closing down? So the aroma of Tacoma is going away in the next, like, few months. So sniff it while you got it, people.
All right, so here is your last question. GQ magazine published a list of the best-smelling cities in the world, including New Orleans, which they praised for what combination of scents? Was it A, incense and sweat? Was it B, old beer and frying fat? Or was it C, strawberry hurricanes and puked-up strawberry hurricanes?
This C sounds so good.
I'm sorry. The answer is B. old beer and frying fat got New Orleans on the good smelling list.
Yeah.
All right, Bill, how did Mark do on our quiz?
Well, he's a winner, 2 out of 3. Mark, congratulations. We'll give you another Emmy for this.
Ronson is a Grammy and Oscar-winning producer, writer, and DJ who composed the score and produced the soundtrack for the Barbie movie. Mark Ronson, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thanks so much.
In November this past year, we talked to ultra runner Tara Dower. She had just become the fastest person to ever complete the Appalachian Trail, having hiked all 2,200 miles in just over 40 days.
The numbers were so unbelievable, Peter had to double-check them.
First question, did we get the numbers right about 2,200 miles, end-to-end, Maine to Georgia, and you did it in 40 days, 18 hours, 5 minutes, is that right?
6 minutes.
Oh, excuse me.
Oh, you are scrupulous.
So break that down. To travel that far in that period of time, how far did you have to travel per day, and how much time did it take to travel, to run every day?
The least amount of miles I did in a day was about 35, and the most I ever did was 62 in a day. And I was every day I was moving for about, on average, like 17 and a half hours a day.
17 and a half hours. Okay. That's kind of amazing. And how much were you able to sleep?
On average, about 5 hours.
And at what point, I mean, I guess you ran from Maine to Georgia, so were you starting to hallucinate by the time you were in New York, say?
Yeah, well, the compounding exhaustion came around, I'd say Maryland, it got pretty bad. I remember some like little hallucinations I had, like little devils sitting on logs.
Oh,
and you know, I saw a white cat and a lion, and I saw my friend sitting on a log.
Oh,
so the hallucinations were getting pretty bad around like the middle of the trail. Maryland is about halfway through.
Well, it's kind of, must be comforting knowing like that's not real. There's not a cat and a devil here. Like, I might as well just keep running. Like, there's no threat, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, I've had hallucinations during 100-mile races that I've done, and some of those have been really concerning.
Yeah.
And I think,
Us an example.
I'm lucky. There was, like, a hunter with a huge, huge, ginormous gun, and he was, like, asking me where I was going and what I was doing, and I was like, oh, crap, like, is this real? And it was in the middle of the night. It was at 2 a.m. on a trail by myself.
You know, if you ask a hallucination, if they're a hallucination, they have to tell you.
That's a rule.
Do you eat while you run?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's, you have to like be utilizing, you have to eat wherever you can. I mean, I'm eating, I think it was like 8 to 10,000 calories a day. So, I mean, you just have to like eat and run. You have to do as much as you can when you run.
And do people
bring you? The only time I stopped during the day was to use the bathroom.
Yeah.
They have bathrooms in the trail. That's nice. And so when you say you're eating, so you're just like people.
She thought it was
up.
A bathroom. You may have been hallucinating a bathroom. Yeah. It could have been someone's car. You can't guarantee that was a bathroom.
So I'm trying to figure out. You're running along, and like your friends are with you. You have a lot of support, I know, in order to do this. And they run up to you, and they hand you a banana or whatever it is you're eating, and you just stuff it in your face as you keep running.
Yep. That's about it. Yeah, just keep moving, eat. My favorite was gummies, and I like Rice Krispie treats and goldfish. I loved goldfish.
Right.
Wow, that's so unhealthy.
Yeah.
It's the calories, though, right?
I was just like, I was expecting you to be like broccoli and then other forms of broccoli.
A couple more questions. First of all, I understand that you said once that you have decided after lots of experiences, negative, positive, but you've just decided that you're done with toenails.
Oh, yeah. I got I got 4 toenails permanently removed before I went out on the trail, and that was the best decision I ever made.
Wow. You just you were done with them. You were like, you were tired of them getting bloody and coming off.
Oh, yeah.
How did
they would
you
fall
choose?
Off all the time.
Were you playing usually, this little piggy? And you were like, this little piggy goes.
This little piggy gets slaughtered.
Yeah, that was it. We just did eeny, meeny, miny, moe. So my big toenails are always the ones during these feats, they always like fall off. And it's very painful and they get infected. And so I was like, that one's coming off. And then, you know, I asked the podiatrist if we could take them all off. And he was like, no, but we can do two at a time. So I decided
it's
on
like
just
Sophie's
a
choice
toenail.
With toes.
What's next? What's the next achievement? And when are you going to be ready to do it?
Yeah, I guess tonight, and to see how fast I can get through, you know, a pint of ice cream.
There you go. Now we're talking. Now we're talking. Well, Tara, we are delighted to talk to you, and we have asked you here to play a game that this time we are calling
Try a Stroll Down These Appalachian Tales.
So you ran the whole Appalachian Trail, but you went through it too fast this last time to hear any of the myths and legends of that particular region. So we're going to ask you three questions about folk tales from the places you ran through. And if you get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, the voice of anyone they like on their voicemail. So Joshua, who is Tara playing for?
Sarah Odell of Redmond, Washington.
Okay. Here we go. Here's your first question about Appalachian tales. In West Virginia, they still celebrate the Mothman. That's the mysterious creature that first appeared in 1966 near Point Pleasant, West Virginia. What was the headline in the Point Pleasant Register newspaper the day after the Mothman's first sighting? Was it A, insects seem to be rather large this year? B, couples see man-sized bird, creature, something? Or C, annual rummage sale draws record crowds?
Oh, I'm going to have to say B.
You're going to go B, couple see man-sized bird, creature, something. You're right.
Yeah.
Yes. To be fair, it was something, and there is now an annual Mothman Festival in Point Pleasant, if you want to go down there and find out all about it.
So cool.
She's like, it's a hallucination.
All right, here's your next question. Now, while Mothman is probably the most famous Appalachian cryptid, he's not the only one out there. Next time you run the trail, you might also run into which of these? A, the phantom trucker who stopped to use the bathroom at south of the border and never returned. B, the lost hiker and angry ghost who died of starvation and demands trail mix from every passerby. Or C, a Bigfoot-like creature called Wood Booger.
Oh, man. I'm going to have to say B.
You're going to go for the lost hiker, the ghost that demands trail mix from every passerby? No, it was the Wood Booger.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's called the Wood Booger because he's like the boogeyman. Not because of his, you know, texture. He's the boogeyman. Okay. Last question. If you get this one right, you win. You've heard of Sasquatch, right? There are stories of Sasquatch in the area. But in West Virginia, there is a terrifying beast that, unlike Sasquatch, walks on all fours, right? Sasquatch stands up. What do they call this mysterious creature? A, the sheep squatch. B, big feet. Or C, independent Senator Joe Manchin.
I would say A.
You're going to go for A, sheep squatch. That's right, Tara.
Yay!
It's called sheep squatch. Because of its thick white fur, or so they say. Joshua, how did Tara Dower do in our quiz?
Well, normally she just got the 2 points, but every one of the toes that she sacrificed is actually worth a quarter point. So we're just going to give you a perfect score. Nicely done!
Yay! Tara Dower is the fastest person ever to complete the Appalachian Trail. Tara Dower, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Yeah.
And get some rest.
Thanks, guys.
Take care. Bye-bye.
This week, we're honoring President's Day by listing as many executives in chief as we can.
So far, I've got Washington, Lincoln, and the guy Harrison Ford played on Air Force One.
We'll keep working on our list. In the meantime, here's some great guests from the recent past. In February of 2023, guest host Peter Gross talked with Tony, Grammy, and Emmy winner Billy Porter, who became iconic for his amazing, elaborate red carpet looks.
Peter asked him about how he almost skipped acting entirely to become a Pentecostal preacher.
And I preached my first sermon when I was probably around 10 or 11, and I knew immediately Nope.
Well, we are all...
It's not the traditional, you know, it's not the traditional way.
We're very happy that you were so unhappy at that point. You are a style and fashion icon in addition to, we'll get to, you know, the performing and stuff that you do, but I'm really... As somebody who, you can't see me, Billy, but I am wearing an extremely boring outfit.
just to follow up on that, Billy, Peter's outfit right now, he bought at whitecisheteroman.com.
Yeah. He kind of looks like he's about to ask us. He looks like he's about to ask us to leave the restaurant.
Adam, you can stay. But no, Billy.
My God, that's hilarious.
My question was going to be, you're always sort of pushing the envelope, and every time you have a look that's goes in a new direction and it's sort of stakes out new ground, do you feel sort of pressure every time you have a new event? Like, what is it like for you to sit with a designer and think, what are we going to do next? How am I going to top my last thing? Or do you even feel that pressure?
No, I don't really feel that because it's what comes naturally for me.
Good.
And I also have a styling team, Ty Hunter and Colin Anderson, and sometimes others.
That's
and,
fun.
You know, I have a lot of, I choose it, but they know what I like.
Yeah, what options to give you.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? Whenever I see people on the red carpet, there's always someone skulking behind them, like tugging at a hem or something, or you know what I mean? Like positioning the gap. Who is that person? And
what is the name of that job?
And how did they get into that job? I just really want to tug at things for a living.
That's really funny. most of the time, it is either a publicist, because they don't let a whole lot of people on the red carpet anymore.
Oh, I know.
Since COVID, you don't have a whole lot of people.
Well, also, Billy, many of your outfits are very large. They take up a lot of space. So you're a perfect person for the COVID era, because if you're wearing, you know... Are there any things that you've worn on the red carpet that's like extremely fashionable and extremely stylish, but also extremely uncomfortable, that then like during the award ceremony or the event that you're in, you're just like, I'm going to change it to some sweatpants because I'm going to sit here for 3 hours. I can't be sitting in this like birdcage looking cape thing or whatever.
you have to think about that and think about what you're going to take off.
Yeah.
The hat that I wore to the Grammys that opened and closed.
Yep. For people who don't know, it was this hat that sort of had this, it was like a 180-degree sort of curtain that was motorized, and he's saying it was very heavy, and it motorized, and it just opened up like a curtain in front of his face.
It hurt so bad, it left a mark.
Oh, oh my God.
It like, almost cut me. It left an indentation. It was so heavy.
I was going to say, you're a singer, you're an actor, you're a director, you have a degree in screenwriting. Is there anything that you're like bad at?
Yes, a lot of stuff. I can't draw. I can't play the piano. That's my biggest dream. I think it's God's way of making sure I stay humble. If I could sit down and play the piano for myself while I sang, I wouldn't be nobody.
So you're in this new movie, 80 for Brady, about four women in their 80s who go see Tom Brady in the Super Bowl. Can you tell us about it?
First of all, it's the gayest sports film ever made. And,
I don't know, Mighty Ducks.
And it creates a conversation subversively. It doesn't seem like we would be together, but yet we are. The story reaches everybody.
Did you talk him into retiring again?
What do you think he should do?
That was not me.
What can you see Tom Brady doing next? What would be a fun sort of like left turn thing for him to do?
I mean, I love you all, and I love Tom Brady, but I don't have the brain space to think about what he should do next.
You got it. This has been
my
really...
brain is already full up.
Good. Yeah, you think about you. You think about you, Billy Porter. And you know what? We're going to think about you, too, because we have asked you here to play a game that we are calling...
And N.B. Davis as Alice.
Your new movie is about a bunch of Tom Brady fans, so we thought that we would ask you about the original Brady Bunch, which is the Brady Bunch.
Okay.
Okay. So answer two of our three questions correctly about the most successful second marriage in TV history, and you will win our prize for one of our listeners. Bill, who is Billy Porter playing for?
Kathy Kim of Los Angeles, California.
All right, here we go. Here's your first question. For our younger listeners, The Brady Bunch was a sitcom about a blended family with three boys and three girls. And one source of tension was that all six kids shared one bathroom, which was especially difficult. Why? Was it A, each kid used a different shampoo, so there was barely room in the shower for a person? B, the bathroom didn't have a toilet? Or C, the bathroom didn't have any doors? Something weird.
I want to say C.
C, the bathroom didn't have any doors?
Yeah.
The answer was actually B. The bathroom did not have
a toilet.
It did not have a toilet.
What?
In 1970, here's why. In 1970, you could not show a toilet on television.
What?
Yep, that's why those kids all held it in for 5 years. Pretty insane. Okay, you still have two chances to win here, Billy, so we're going to keep going. Here's your next question.
Okay. I watched The Brady Bunch a lot, but I didn't watch it like that.
I'm glad you didn't. I'm glad you didn't. In one of the most famous episodes, Peter Brady hits Marsha with a football and he breaks her nose. So how did the director of the episode film that stunt? Was it A, they used a macrame football that the director's wife had made? Was it B, Maureen McCormick, the actress who played Marsha, threw a football away from her face and then they ran the film backwards? Or was it C, they actually hit Maureen McCormick in the face with a football?
All right, I'll say C.
You'd be right.
Yay!
Very good. They actually did it several times, apparently, because the prop guy off-screen kept missing her nose.
Wow.
So they had to do it over and over again. Okay, here's your last question. If you get it right, you're going to
win. See, that's before there were laws.
Yeah.
It's called Marsha's
Law. We got laws in place now.
It's called Marsha's Law.
It's called Marsha's Law. Very specific. You can't throw anything harder than a taco at someone's face. I don't know. All right, here's your last question. Nowadays, the Brady Bunch is considered a classic, but in the 1970s, the cast, they weren't really such a big deal. For example, which of these is true? Was it A, they had to pay to park at the lot at ABC? B, the cast was not provided food except for the bag lunches that Carol Brady made during the episode. Or C, the then president of ABC thought that all of their last names were actually Brady.
I think A.
You'd be right again. It was A. They had to pay to park at ABC. Bill, how did the other Bill, Billy Porter, do on our quiz?
Billy Porter got 2 out of 3. You won, Billy.
Great job.
Oh, thank you.
Billy, it was a pleasure. You are a treasure. And it was just a real joy to talk to you. Yeah. You can see Billy Porter in the new film, 80 for Brady. Billy Porter, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Finally, in June of 2023, we talked with actor James Marsden, who had just starred in Jury Duty, the hidden camera sitcom where one normal, unsuspecting guy thought he was the foreman on a real case and that one of his fellow jurors was actor James Marsden. You know what? We'll just let him explain it.
Basically, it was how do we create the office with populate the jury duty with a bunch of the improv artists, myself playing a kind of heightened version of myself, a sort of entitled Hollywood celebrity version of myself, and one guy that thinks the whole thing is real.
So, but I'm very curious as to how you got involved in this very experimental thing. I imagine they say to you, we want you to play this arrogant version of yourself to see if we can annoy our hero enough to hate you, and the whole thing may be a complete disaster, in which case everyone will hate you for pranking this guy. And you're like, yeah. Sign me up?
Absolutely. Well, I guess I'd be lying to you if I said it didn't sound fun to kind of lampoon your, and like I said, the entitled Hollywood actor who just wants every conversation to be about him.
Right, right. So you've been talking about it, doing a lot of interviews, and I read that you said that at certain points during the production, you actually began to worry if you were the one that they were trying to fool somehow. Like if the real thing was, let's get James Marsden and tell him that we're doing this thing with another person who doesn't know that it's fake, but in reality, that's an actor, and James won't know that it's fake.
It's really true. I mean, you just I've never done a project like this, so you don't trust anyone. You know, you don't.
The final episode, or rather the penultimate episode, you reveal everything to him. And how did it feel on that day? Were you guys worried about what his reaction would be? Were you afraid, for example, he'd freak out and be angry or upset or something?
Yes. We were more nervous about that moment than any other moment in the show because, you know, you just think, well, if that was me, how would I react? I mean, I can't even handle a surprise birthday party,
right,
let alone being surrounded by, you know, everyone in his reality for 3 weeks was putting on a show. And that's a long time to mess with somebody's human experience, 3 weeks of their life. So we made sure that we all ran up to him immediately afterwards and let him know that, yes, all those, you know, the kind of absurd circumstances that we put him through was fake, but the friendships and, like, getting to know each other, that was all very real.
Right. And I heard that you had to spend time with him and, like, talk him down and, like, assure him that you really, after it was all over, and, like, no, I really like you, we're friends.
So I kept in touch with him for a good, you know, couple of weeks, months after, just checking on him to see how he was doing. And he was like, a couple of weeks after, he was like, am I still being filmed?
Really? He's like, James, is there a camera in the flower pot? Really?
No, I was like, there's no reason why you should believe me, but I promise you, it's all over, my friend.
Oh, God.
All you can do is keep it a secret for 1 year now until the show comes out.
Exactly.
No problem.
You, in your remarkable and eclectic career, have played the guy who gets the girl, like in 27 Dresses, and you play the guy who should get the girl but doesn't, like in The Notebook.
Go on, twist the knife.
You have to agree with, like, every right-thinking person that in The Notebook, Rachel McAdams should have married you. I mean, come on.
Well, that didn't create quite a stir in the audience there, though.
No.
Not as much as you might have hoped.
There's a young generation now that, like, she should have been with you. The relationship with Noah was a toxic relationship.
Really? Well, James Marsden, it is a pleasure to talk to you, and we have invited you here to play a game we're calling...
Objection.
So as we have been talking about, you served on this fake jury, so we thought it would be a natural thing to ask you 3 questions about real juries. Get 2 of these right, you will win our prize for one of our listeners. Bill, who is James Marsden playing for?
Shane Gill of Cleveland, Ohio.
All right. Ready to play?
I'm going to have to. I'm going to try. I'm going to crack.
Here we go. Here's your first question. The jurors in a murder trial in Britain in 1994 arrived at their guilty verdict by doing what? A, observing that the defendant had his fingers crossed during the whole trial. B, asking a Ouija board if he did it or not. Or C, waiting for the made-for-TV movie to be produced about the trial and then seeing how that ended.
I'm just going to have a little fun and go with A.
You're going to go with A, that he had his fingers crossed the whole time on the stand. No, it was actually the Ouija board.
What?
They were sequestered as you were in jury duty, and they got together in one of the hotel rooms, and they pulled out a Ouija board, and they asked him if the guy was guilty, and he was. Once discovered, the verdict was reversed. Okay, you have 2 more chances. A juror in another British case got sentenced for contempt of court. What did she do that was so bad? Was it A, every time the plaintiff spoke, the juror made the law and order dun-dun sound? B, she insisted that she outranked the jury foreman because she was the five-man. Or C, she friended the defendant on Facebook and kept him updated on what was going on in the jury room.
I'm going to go with C.
You're right. That's what she did. Interestingly, in that case, the juror served 2 months for contempt of court, and the defendant got off entirely because of the mistrial. All right, here's your last question. Get this one right, you win. Here we go. One juror in a trial a while ago said he couldn't serve in the jury because he had terrible gas. And the judge refused that request, not a good excuse, put him on the jury, and then what happened? A, he eventually farted so terribly in court that the judge vomited and a lawyer fainted. B, his story was made into the classic courtroom film 12 Stinky Men. Or C, the man exploded.
I'm going to have to go with A. I mean, all of these sound crazy.
That's what happened, apparently.
Wow.
The judge should have listened. Wow. Bill, how did James Marsden do in our quiz?
He won our game completely with 2 out of 3 right.
There you go. That's the verdict. James Marsden stars in Jury Duty. It's on Amazon. Trust me, try it, and you will probably spend the rest of the night watching the whole thing. James Marsden, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you.